Welcome to Parents' Perspective. When my 11-year-old son returned from his first summer away, I stockpiled all of his favorite foods for an emotional return and a comforting family dinner. He walked in, announced that he was heartbroken to have to come home, and P.S., he had become a vegetarian. How can we, as parents, provide proper nutrition for our children? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Here to help satisfy our hunger for nutritional information are Faye Berger Mitchell, who is a registered dietitian and nutrition consultant in private practice. She's the mother of a 3-year-old. Welcome, Faye.
Thank you.
And Ann Litt, who has been a nutritionist since 1976 with a specialty in weight control issues for parents and children. She has 2 teenage sons. We're glad to have you with us, Ann.
Thank you.
Faye, how appropriate for children are the recommended daily allowances for food?
I think the recommended daily allowances help scientists and nutritionists figure out whether children are getting enough to eat. But I hate to see parents bogged down with counting and numbers and that type of thing. I think it's most important that they really present their children with foods, whole foods and healthy foods, fruits, vegetables, grains, and small amounts of meats, and make sure that they get enough milks and dairy products and not worry so much about the numbers.
And what are the different nutritional needs for children at different ages and stages of growth?
Forever, really, children's nutritional needs parallel their developmental needs. And so from early on, babies are fed milk because developmentally all they can do is suck. And if you use that as your guidelines for how to introduce foods to children and what to expect when you do introduce foods to children, makes it a lot easier. So as they get older and they can use some chewing movements, then they can be eating foods which require chewing. A very good example is babies should not really be fed solids until they can sit with some support. So the idea of feeding an infant cereal when they're 8 weeks old is really ridiculous, because think of how you would feel if somebody were feeding you in a reclining position. It goes all through the life cycle like that. A 2-year-old is really at their no, no, no stage, and developmentally that's what they're supposed to be saying, and they reject food. Whereas an adolescent's life is a mess and their eating habits are a mess. And that's sort of the way I think about their nutritional needs more than specific nutrients, because as Faye said, if we think about food rather than numbers, it's a lot easier to feed kids well.
Now, what would you tell the parent of a 2-year-old, for example, who's doing the no-no-nos?
Well, I guess our philosophy will come out early on here. Faye and I both believe that a parent's responsibility is to buy the food, to purchase the food, to establish an age-appropriate feeding schedule. And a child's responsibility is to eat or to not eat. And once you do your job by placing food in front of your child, your job's done. So when your 2-year-old starts rejecting food, they're not really rejecting food and they're not rejecting you. They're just doing what a 2-year-old's supposed to do. You, as the parent, continue doing your job, placing the food, removing it when it's not eaten, and don't comment on it. And eventually that too shall pass. 2-year-olds also don't grow at the same rate that other little babies do. And so they don't really need the same kind of nutrients or amounts of food that your, you know, previously hungry 15-month-old might have needed.
Well, what about the 2-year-old who rejects food at meals, but then half an hour later is perfectly ready to have a snack?
Your job is to really establish an age-appropriate feeding schedule. And your 2-year-old should understand the consequences of not eating at mealtime. And the consequences are you wait until your next established meal or snack. And certainly 2-year-olds need to eat quite frequently, but you want to avoid being in the position of handing out food on the dole. So once they understand that there is some pattern, and they like patterns, kids, you know, enjoy predictability and feel comfortable with a meal pattern, then that you can pretty much say, well, next meal you can have something to eat.
We had one son who became addicted to yogurt and peanut butter and bread. And this was son number one, so I took him to the pediatrician, and I was, you know, what should I do now? And the pediatrician said, how fortunate you are. You know, he's eating very nutritional things. Let him eat them as much as he wants to. He won't do it very long. He did for several months. He ate that, but he was fine.
Food jags are very common with kids these age. I have a three-year-old, so I am speaking from experience. Every day she tells me what food she's decided not to eat anymore. Yesterday it was spaghetti, and the day before it was broccoli. And I say, okay, and I serve to her whatever the family meal is. You make a family meal, you put it on your table, and whatever your child chooses to eat or not to eat is fine. But what we don't want to get into is getting into short order cooking or presenting different foods for each different member of the family. Just make sure there's something that each child eats. We're on a bread and butter food jag right now. But they go through a phase and they'll eat that same food for a while and then they'll get to their next phase. So if parents are worried about whether their kids are getting adequate nutrition, I tell them to look at the global picture, not the daily picture. So try to look at the week or a couple weeks' time. And it's interesting, they do sort of take in what they need.
How do the nutritional requirements change for an athletic or especially active child? And how can parents encourage the necessary intake?
That's a tough one because kids, once they become more active and once they're athletic, they do need more calories. For example, if your child is going from school to an athletic event, and they may have had lunch at 10 o'clock that morning because a lot of kids, 10, 10:30, they're having lunch, make sure you bring them or pack them a healthy snack. I like to say pack them something that might even be a small lunch, a sandwich, a peanut butter sandwich would be something healthy, or crackers and some cheese sticks, which is very portable and easier for them to eat. Things that are more meal-type things rather than sweets and sugary foods.
Kids don't drink to quench their thirst. And I think it's a coach's responsibility to give kids guidelines about fluid intake before, during, and after an event. The fluid after the event is as important as fluid during an event.
Do you have recommendations for dealing with weight gain or loss for specific sports? We hear about football players or wrestlers who have to weigh into certain categories.
I think parents have to be very careful when we're getting into this issue because, unfortunately, I've seen kids in my office, as has Anne, who have developed eating disorders, trying to make weight for certain sports. So I think on one hand, we need to try to encourage our children to go for those sports that their body is best suited for. If they're a very thin, small child, then they're not going to gain a lot of weight to become a football player. It's just not going to happen. And it's very hard and it's very difficult for the child to really see that. Another thing a parent can do is try to work with the coach and try and set some sort of a realistic way in which that child can work within the framework. But often, even if a child's trying to make a weight, lose weight, gain weight, whatever it may be, their body doesn't allow it and they're not going to do it. So we have to be careful. Kids might get into starving or not drinking fluids in order to get at a low weight when they're being weighed in. I think that's when a parent does need to step in and set some limits and say, hey, this is not healthy. Maybe we need to go for something else, choose another sport or choose a different weight class or whatever that might be.
Moving on to fluids in general, and what is an appropriate level of fluid intake for children?
There are specific guidelines, again, particularly for infants who have much higher fluid needs than adults. But what I use as a rule of thumb is look at the color of their urine. And as long as their urine is coming out pale, then they're getting adequate fluid. Another way of determining it, a lot of kids are constipated, and the constipation is often due to lack of fluids. So if they have clear urine and they're not constipated, then I think you can assume that they're getting enough fluids.
How can we get children to drink healthful drinks when they're faced with the soda machines and all that kind
now,
of stuff?
There's the question. I always say if I could figure out something that was good for you and tasted good and didn't cost a lot of money, I'd really be in business. Water really is the number one fluid choice for replacing fluids. I think that we want to encourage kids to eat fruit rather than drink a lot of fruit juice. Parents are under the misconception that because fruit is healthy, fruit juice must be healthy also. And unfortunately, fruit juice carries a lot of calories without a lot of nutrients per calorie. And so I encourage kids to drink a glass of fruit juice a day, but really to get the bulk of their fluids needs met through water. A real good way to do it is the family meals. Everybody should be drinking water. With little children, if you want to make it interesting by putting a straw in the water, by putting water in thermos, by putting water in water bottles, by putting lemon in water, those are all good tricks. But I think parents need to model the behavior of drinking fluids.
Let me add on to that. I think parents also, when they're introducing liquids in a cup to their children, I always recommend they start with water because that's a pattern that is being set up for that child's life. My daughter didn't start drinking juice till like this year because she, at nursery school they drank juice. But we just never really had a whole lot of it around the house. And I'm not saying don't allow it for your child, but just sort of introduce the other things first.
Is there a difference between one fruit juice and another? I always heard that apple juice was pretty atrocious, but orange juice was good. Are those
true? Well, the first thing is if you're going to use fruit juice, you want to make sure it's 100% fruit juice. And there's a difference between fruit drinks and fruit juice. Orange juice, grapefruit juice, the nectars do have more nutrients than apple juice. Some of the apple juices are now fortified with certain nutrients. But in general, apple juice isn't packed with a lot of nutrients. And certainly a serving a day is not a problem. If your child wants to bring a box drink of juice to lunch, that's perfectly fine. But I think what you want to get out of the habit of or not start to begin with is just lots of juice, apple juice, whenever they're thirsty. When they're thirsty, you want to encourage them to drink water. And certainly kids should be drinking milk. And I don't have a problem with a child who's at a fast food restaurant or in a restaurant in general. If they wanted a soda, that's not a problem. But probably as a family rule, you don't want to have lots and lots of sodas in your house, or they will certainly take preference over water.
Speaking of sodas, the ingredient of caffeine comes up a lot. How do you feel about that?
We don't know of any limit or amount that's really needed for health. And so certainly we could all live fine without caffeine. And actually, there's a study going on right now to determine how much caffeine it might be dangerous for children. I don't think we have a number on that right now. But I think it should be limited. It's certainly not something we know that is needed for good health.
Is it something that could be harmful? I mean, for example, there's kids who want to taste coffee. And we all think, oh, my goodness, what a terrible thing because of the caffeine.
Or tea. Coke. People give them tea when they're sick.
I don't think it's a terrible thing for kids to want to taste those things and to allow them to taste foods like that. But I think that you need to make the point that it's not something that's good for children. And I certainly wouldn't recommend tea or coffee as a beverage on a regular basis. Probably the more problematic drink, though, is Coca-Cola, which has a lot of caffeine in it.
Keep in mind that caffeine can be habit-forming. So even in small doses, if you're used to a certain dosage of caffeine every day, then adults do experience this, as could kids. If they don't have that caffeine dose, they could have mild headaches. So if a child is used to every single day having a certain amount of caffeine, per se, in colas or that type of thing, they could create a habit.
Faye, what should be the role of nutritional supplements in a child's diet?
I think in general, we need to make sure that our kid eats a well-balanced diet, and then we don't have to worry about supplements per se. Occasionally, there may be a situation where a child does not get certain nutrients, vitamins, minerals, for example, calcium. If a child is lactose intolerant or is allergic to dairy products, we may look at supplementing calcium. Or sometimes, occasionally, you may find a child whose iron is low. They may supplement some iron. On a cross-the-board principle, we don't need to give our children vitamins. We think that if they eat a well-balanced diet, lots of fruits and vegetables again, and grains and all types of healthy-type foods, and make sure they're drinking their milk and getting their dairy products, then we shouldn't have to supplement them with vitamins.
Are natural supplements better than vitamin pills?
Not necessarily. It's really been shown that there's about two or three companies in the entire United States that makes all the vitamin compounds. And then the companies buy them and they put them together, and some of them are packaged as natural based on, I think, the binders that they use or whether they've added a little bit of sugar or what they're holding those vitamins and minerals together with. But the actual vitamin and mineral itself is the same compound no matter what vitamin you're getting it from. So a generic vitamin would be equal to a vitamin that's very expensive from a health food store.
Your body doesn't make a distinction between a natural vitamin and a synthetic vitamin. The exception might be, though, with certain minerals like calcium. Because calcium is absorb differently, and certain mineral supplements that contain calcium are different. Not necessarily the more expensive ones are better, but you should really ask your pharmacist which ones are best absorbed, especially if you're taking other vitamins and minerals or medications.
Is there anything that prevents absorption of calcium? If you're taking calcium,
yes.
Is there something else?
You shouldn't take calcium and iron at the same time. And certain things enhance the absorption of calcium. For instance, lactose or milk, which is why milk is such an excellent source of calcium.
Faye, when my first one was very little and sitting in a high chair, I had a neighbor who was watching me feed him. And he was a very good eater. He ate whatever I fed him, and he finished it all up. And I was ready to take the dish away, and she said, "What? He finished it all up. You're supposed to give him more till he doesn't want it anymore." And I, of course, being a new mother, thought, well, maybe this was the right thing to do. How do we know what is the right amount to feed a child?
This is a very difficult issue, particularly for first-time parents, because we don't get guidelines on this, and it's really we're sort of questioning what we're doing anyway. But it's really important to take the cue from your child. And if you watch children as they're eating, let's say you're feeding your child and you put the spoon up to his or her mouth, and the child turns their mouth away, then they're not hungry. But if the child opens up the mouth and puts their mouth around the spoon and takes it, then they are hungry. It's tough to know how much to give them. Keep in mind, though, that portions for little ones, infants who are just learning how to eat, babies, are tablespoons. So we're talking about portions being 1 to 2 tablespoons. And that's about a half of the size of a woman's palm of their hand. So that's not a lot. So parents think that they need to put half cups or cups of portions, and that just is way too much for many children.
Babies from an early age can self-regulate, and we just need to trust them to do that. It's only when we interfere and project what we think they should be eating that we disrupt what they can do naturally.
You've heard of this where you're playing airplane and you're trying to get the food into the child's mouth, or, you know, you're saying, open up, open up, open up. And that really is not necessary. The child is going to eat when he or she wants to and stop when they're full.
And what should parents know about weight gain in children?
Very good question. Each child is genetically programmed to grow at their own rate. And the important thing to know is that at different ages, kids are expected to gain different amounts of weight. So, for instance, little babies double their birth weight by 4 to 6 months and triple their birth weight by 10 to 12 months. So if you have a baby that was born at 9 pounds, which is not unusual these days, they should weigh 27 pounds by the end of a year. Whereas you can have a friend who had a baby who was born at 6 pounds, and that baby should weigh 18 pounds. That's a very big difference for two children that both are 1 year old. I see the biggest concerns coming with adolescents as they grow, because they are supposed to gain weight, and they gain weight way before they actually grow. And the weight gain sometimes scare parents, particularly as girls start laying down fat in anticipation of growth. So if you have a little girl growing at the 5th percentile and a little girl growing at the 75th percentile, the expected weight gain is going to be very, very different. 5th percentile little girl might be expected to gain 6 pounds in a year, and the larger little girl might be expected to gain 20 pounds in a year, and both of those are considered acceptable.
Now, there are weight and height charts available that parents can consult. How should parents interpret that information?
They should really look at their child's own particular growth curve, not that they should all have 50th percentile children. There are children that are 5th percentile and children that are 90th percentile. And really, as long as they stay at the same percentile and you don't see large differences in their growth pattern, that's the way they're supposed to be.
And I guess now is the time to talk about eating disorders. Do you want to define what an eating disorder is and how parents can recognize them?
There are really three main types of eating disorders: anorexia nervosa, which is a conscious decision not to eat, to starve; bulimia, which is where people eat large quantities and get rid of it in some way, purging it in some way. Purging can be either by vomiting, by excessive use of laxatives, or by exercising greater than what's considered reasonable. And then there's binge eating disorder and compulsive overeating. And really with kids, the two main type of eating disorders that we encounter most would be bulimia and anorexia nervosa.
And how can parents recognize when this is going on if they're not actually seeing the purging take place? What would be
signs? I think bulimia is hard for parents to really see because often these are children that are normal weight. And somebody often brings it to a parent's attention that their child is bulimic, whereas with anorexia, it's pretty obvious as your child starts refusing foods, exercising a lot, becoming totally self-absorbed with anything that has to do with food, like cooking, reading lots of magazines, and they start losing a lot of weight. Anorexia is much easier to identify, although Faye and I both see kids often where they've lost a tremendous amount of weight, and it's not until it's really gotten pretty far that the parents actually recognize that there's a problem. I think there's a tremendous amount of denial with kids who develop eating disorders.
Are there any physical symptoms that parents can watch out for?
With anorexia, the biggest physical symptom is that girls stop menstruating. If they've gotten their periods, they do stop menstruating. Other things that I think parents can observe about their children is an intolerance to cold. They start feeling very, very cold in situations where you normally wouldn't see somebody feeling cold. In advanced cases of anorexia, you see, you know, kids' hair falling out in clumps and very low level of energy in really advanced cases, although in kids who are just developing anorexia, it's the opposite. They seem to have endless energy because they need to always move to get rid of the calories.
With bulimics, sometimes a parent can also look for a couple things which are not easy to determine, but some people say that the cheeks sort of like a chipmunk-like appearance, that you can actually see some sort of widening of the throat and cheek-like area. And the other thing is you can look for signs. Some girls use their hands to force themselves to vomit, and sometimes you'll see sort of red or rough-looking hands since they've forced their hands down their throat. Oh. Not a pleasant topic to talk about, I know.
But it's important to
yes.
know.
Yeah.
Now, if parents see any of these signs, calling the pediatrician is the first step. Is that right?
That's a good place to start. It's a team effort to help these children get better. And you can consult a pediatrician. You can consult a nutritionist who has experience with eating disorders. You can consult a therapist. And probably will end up consulting all three.
Mm-hmm. And it's more than just the problem of the individual child. It sounds like it's a family concern.
Right. Usually what we say is that the eating is a symptom of a much larger problem. It's the way of calling attention to some other large problem.
Mm-hmm. What percentage of these children get better?
The things that we know that help kids get better are the quicker they get into treatment.
And what are the special needs or considerations for children who become vegetarians? I've had to learn really fast.
Right. Well, there are different types of vegetarians. If your child chooses to be a lacto-ovo-vegetarian, which is one that still includes dairy products and eggs, then their nutritional needs can easily be met because just omitting meat really doesn't decrease their intake of any important nutrients that they can't get through other animal products. As their diets become more and more restrictive, as they eliminate milk, eggs, etc., then you need to look closely at, first of all, total calorie intake. You would want to make sure that they're getting a source of calcium. Dairy products provide us with a lot of calcium. If calcium is omitted from the diet, they need to look for non-dairy sources, which would include dark green leafy vegetables. It would include tofu that's been fortified. It would include fortified soybean milk. Another nutrient which could be lacking in a total vegetarian diet is iron. And the way I get the kids that I work with who are vegans to get enough iron is there are so many iron-fortified cereals out there. So a bowl of iron-fortified cereal with some soy milk can help meet their iron needs. Cooking in a cast iron pan can help increase iron needs. And beans, which we hope most vegetarians are using in their diets regularly, are good sources of iron. And lastly, if they're a total vegetarian, they need to find a source of vitamin B12 because that is only found in animal products. And there are some fortified B12 products now, like soy milk, and some tofu is fortified.
Faye, what are the consequences of poor nutrition?
Many children skip breakfast, and they get up, they go to school, they haven't had breakfast, and studies show that they're not learning well. You can't function and you can't think when you're not eating breakfast. So I think that what we tend to see is children who just aren't performing at their peak levels. if you see a child who seems to be tired a lot, fatigued, lethargic, that could be an indication of poor nutrition, and you may need to make sure that your child either gets up earlier to have some breakfast or pack some sort of a snack with them, that if they're really not hungry when they get up in the morning, maybe you could pack like a bagel and some cheese for them to take with them so that when they do get hungry, they have something to eat.
We'd like to thank our guests, Faye Berger-Mitchell and Ann Litt, for joining us today and bringing us their experience and advice. We've enjoyed our discussion with you. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective.
Are there topics you would like to hear about on this program? If you would like to send comments, questions, or suggestions to Parents' Perspective, you can email us at parentspur@aol.com or contact us care of this station. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burke.